Hey everyone, this is Mike. I just want to give you the heads up that in today's episode, we tackle the sensitive topic of sex and sexual purity for the Christian. And so if you're a parent and you listen with children around in the car or at home, I invite you just to hit pause and listen to it at a later time or have the kids go into another room while you listen to it. We do believe that this topic is important for parents to think about as they disciple their kids and for leaders and churches to think about as they disciple youth in their ministry context. And so we hope you enjoy this podcast and thanks for listening. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Mike Kresnick, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune of Corumdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about purity culture, helpful or harmful?
I'm already so conflicted about this podcast. We've been sitting here for 15 minutes without the mics on, just talking about this. The genesis of this podcast is an article that appeared recently in the New York Times on June 15th. And that's actually the reason we're talking about it is because the New York Times put it out there. And I think anytime something like the New York Times tease this up, I'm like, oh, I want to talk about this because people are talking about it and because the New York Times has a certain amount of cultural capital in our world as people think about journalism. The title of the article is How Should Christians Have Sex? Which bugs me.
She doesn't answer in the article.
Yeah, it's such a clickbait title. Just like, oh, that's not Christians and sex, click, right? That's what the New York Times is doing here. The writer is Caitlin Beatty. And what she's writing about, she's reflecting on her own life, and what she calls purity culture. I don't know who invented that term. I don't like that term, but she's talking about in the 1990s and 2000s, this whole movement, the True Love Waits kind of movement within American Christianity, where there was this big emphasis on helping Christian youth embrace sexual purity and make promises and pledges about sexual purity and purity rings and purity pledges and all these, this emphasis on helping kids embrace an ethic of sexual purity. And she's sort of in an autobiographical way, reflecting on the beauty of that and the brokenness of that and the ways it's sort of helped her and the ways it's complicated her life. And so what's interesting is when the New York Times takes something like that and puts it on the, you know, page of their paper, they're provoking a fuller conversation among people in America on this topic. Here's why I'm conflicted about it. As we've been talking, the essential question Caitlin Beatty asks in this article is, I find myself mourning the loss of the coherent sexual ethic that purity culture tried to offer. Is consent culture the best that we have in its place? Huh. So she's sort of saying there is this emphasis on purity, and I miss that because it seems like what it's been replaced with is just like a bare notion of consent. She, I think, is critical of some of the things that came along with purity culture, and I'm going to argue maybe with some of her arguments there. We're going to debate them. So she has some things to critique about what she refers to as purity culture. But she also laments the loss of it because she says that now all we have is just like this rubric of consent where it's just like, well, make sure you get consent. Mm. And that's just not the same kind of ethic. That's just not mm-hmm. It doesn't have the same fullness. And so it's intriguing, both the things she's lamenting and also the question of what would a fuller, more robust biblical sexual ethic look like? She ends the article by saying this: I still find the traditional vision for married sex radical, daunting, and extremely compelling, and one I still want to uphold, even if I fumble along the way. That's the way the article ends. So she's saying, man, there's something about this vision that's powerful and compelling. She spends the rest of the article sort of, I don't know, lampooning various aspects of purity culture. All right, y'all. Chime in, Bethany. Bethany Gilbert. Bethany told us you had some purity rings.
Oh, I had like two or three purity rings. I signed that pledge probably two or three times. So I don't know. I I enjoyed this article because I felt like, oh man, did Caitlin and I attend the same youth group? Because she's mentioning experiences that I had, the spit in a cup and pass it around. And at the end, the youth pastor's like, all right, this is what you're like if you have sex with, you know, all these people before you're married. So,
or even kiss that many people.
Oh yeah. Or even kiss. Yeah. So
gross.
Let's just spitting, yeah, people just spitting in a cup.
Yeah, that's just disgusting.
That's a powerful image for something.
It is, but I don't know.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think kind of like how you said you were feeling conflicted, Bob, like I feel a little conflicted because while, as a young woman in high school or in middle school and high school, walking through that, there were some kind of shame inducing things that it definitely brought about. But, ultimately I think like the intentions behind it were good. And, I just don't know that it was necessarily, that it played out super well in my youth group context.
I think there are many who would agree with you that where I'm conflicted is if I think about what do I want for my kids? What do I want for the youth of our churches? I want them to embrace sexual purity.
Right.
I want them to walk in sexual purity, and I want them to enjoy the fruit of a marriage where that's been preserved and protected until then. And that mm-hmm. was the thing that I think my youth leaders were committed to, was just like, I want you to embrace the beauty of that and the importance of that. So here's what I wrote down as I was sort of thinking about this. The subtitle of this article says, purity culture was harmful and dangerous, but its collapse has left a void for those of us looking for guidance in our intimate lives. I just thought, I don't agree that purity culture was harmful and dangerous. I think it was moralistic and it had some imbalances. Mm-hmm. So I would just use different adjectives there. I wouldn't say it was harmful and dangerous. I would say it was thin and probably unbalanced in the ways that you said, Bethany. I think it emphasized an ethic which is biblical. Mm. But sometimes in doing so, it created a sense of shame that was deep. Mm-hmm. And so there were, I was saying before we turned on the mics, I think purity culture was thin rather than thick. It was like a lowest common denominator ethic of don't do this. It probably didn't give a fuller picture of all of God's design for married sexuality.
Right.
It might have lacked that. It might have been sort of, hey, don't do this. And so that makes me feel like it was missing some things, but I don't want to not have that ethic. Mm-hmm. You know, like I don't want to say, well, that doesn't matter. I want to say, no, man, that still does matter.
Well, that's kind of what she says at the end of the article, right?
Yes, like
she's still looking for something that with that ethic in mind, but the church hasn't replaced.
And it feels like what
the thinness of the purity.
It feels like what she's saying with the idea of purity culture is sort of what you mentioned, Bethany. It's like the ethic, but also all that sort of went along with that, the exercises and the pressure and the signing the pledge, like all the things that came with that, that sort of, it seemed like every youth group in America sort of signed on and said, let's all push the same agenda in these same ways. Mm-hmm. And maybe she's missing the ethic, but not missing the ways it was applied or taught.
Yeah. I think the thing that, when I think back on it, there was just never a robust discussion about what sex in a Christian marriage should look like and would look like. And I think it was because, honestly, I think that was maybe done out of fear. Like, we can't talk about sex with high school kids because it's just going to make them want to have it more or something. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that makes me kind of sad because you're assuming that high schoolers can't, like, I don't know, that they're dumb or they're just not... they're not mature enough. So, and I think that that's maybe what was needed, was just a more robust discussion about what it actually looks like and why it's beautiful and why it's compelling, instead of, I mean, for me, don't do this because you will get pregnant or you will get an STD. That was it. I was like, okay, all right, well, I want to follow the rules. So,
and even conversely, if you save yourself, if you do all the things you're supposed to do, then boy, when you get married, sex will be amazing. Mm-hmm. Everything will work out great. Mm-hmm. God will bless you. And so there is, I think it overpromised too.
Yeah.
Like it certainly moved you in the direction of purity is good. And there's definite fruitfulness and blessing in your marriage when you pursue purity before you're married, but it doesn't guarantee some of the things that I think, if not necessarily explicitly, were implicitly spoken of as well. I mean, she mentions having a wait for me journal and, you know, writing letters to her future husband, and how there was this expectation that kind of practice was the kind of spiritual maturity that would lead her to a husband. And she was, you know, waiting for and you know, not making a bad decision. And yet she says she's 34 and unmarried, and she's a committed Christian. But so there was maybe even some expectations that were in these practices, you're going to get a good result. I think I saw maybe more of that. I mean, I saw a lot of the shame and the fear. But I think, especially when it came to marriage, I mean, you know, I Kissed Dating Goodbye, Joshua Harris's book, like how that affected, you know, the friends that I went to high school and college. You know, if I do all this stuff, if I follow Joshua Harris's book, I'm going to get married. And then, you know, we have friends that are pushing 40, not married, and they're kind of upset about it.
Mm-hmm.
It feels to me like what we're... If we feel like, hey, most of Christian culture in that season of time was moralistic, like why did the gospel-centered movement arise? Because right. There was a strong strain of moralism and legalism in the church. Well, why would we be surprised if that was present in our youth groups?
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
As I look back and go, yeah, I wish we had a more gospel-driven framework, a more glory of God-driven framework for this. Well, yeah, but but that would have been great in the whole church. You know?
Yeah.
So, like, I feel like there's, in a sense, ways that what we've fought for in our own ministries over the last couple decades has been a real gospel-centeredness that doesn't lean into just moralism and doesn't just give law and rules, but that gives a broader framework of grace and holiness and ethic and covenant and all these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's, as I read this article, the thing that was provoking for me was I know that I have at times been reactionary to some of the quote unquote purity culture practices, but am I articulating as a pastor, articulating something better, a better vision for purity, for godliness?
I would say fuller.
Fuller. There you go.
Because we don't want
fuller.
Less than purity. We just want more than that.
Right, right, right. Yes, yes. So what are the practices? How am I filling that out? A greater theology of sexuality and the body and marriage and how those things play together in God's design. And then how am I articulating the sort of discipleship practices that we want to see happen in our churches and in our families?
Mm-hmm.
And I came to the conclusion, I think I could get at some of those, but I don't know if I have as good an answer as I should in some ways. And so this really provoked me to think, you know, what are we proactively teaching? What kind of are the liturgies, so to speak, in our churches that are cultivating a godly purity in our kids that we would say fills the picture out.
Yeah,
as
that's
you say,
the challenge for me is I feel like I'm trying to do that as best I can as a father.
Mm.
I don't even think like we haven't built anything in our church for this. So I'm like we have actually less than what my high school youth group had to talk about this.
Yeah, right? That's fascinating.
And so I'm just like, well, I don't think we're doing a good job there. You know, like I think we certainly need at least what our high school youth group had, and hopefully more fullness. You know,
yeah.
So I feel like we're behind the curve on some of these things. And
do you not think though that the groundwork that, let's just use Coramdale as an example, for the last 15 years that we've been laying with a gospel centeredness and like teaching young parents to talk to their kids early to the age of 5 about their bodies and sexuality and what God designed for sex, that's laying a different groundwork than what maybe my parents had, you know, becoming Christians in the late 80s. They were just dealing with the tools that they had in the moment because there was nothing like that back then. And they're growing up in the sexual revolution and they're just responding to the culture that they see coming to the forefront. Hey, we gotta do the purity ring thing. You know?
I hope, my answer is I hope so.
Yeah.
But what's I'm feeling a couple tensions. One is, if we're saying, hey, this purity culture was a really law-based ethic and it, you know, it wasn't wrong, but it was incomplete. I just feel like we've kind of swung the pendulum to where we don't talk about law. We don't talk about obedience. We don't talk about morality. We just sort of talk about gospel-y things. And so I don't know that we would just like, we need to be looking at our kids and being like, hey, don't have sex before you're married. Like, this is a command the Lord gives. Now, let me give a fuller reason why that all matters. But the command, the ethic, the law still matters. And it feels to me sometimes like we just don't say that very much. It's like we say nothing about that. So that's one of my place where I feel conflicted. The other place is, I feel like in this article, Caitlin Beatty, you know, she, here's what she says, for instance, in one sentence. Rather than emphasize the gift of sex within marriage, purity culture typically led with the shame of having sex outside of it. I see the contrast she's making there, and I, at one level, I agree. I think, okay, yep, we didn't the some of the world we grew up in evangelicalism did not emphasize the gift of sex within, which is what you were just saying, Bethany. My concern is, the thing I want to say as a pastor that I feel like this article in a very ham-handed way does a poor job with is to say any kind of sexual sin always brings with it shame. The culture doesn't create shame. Sin creates shame, and especially sexual sin. There's every one of us who's worked with people dealing with sexual sin. There's shame is one of the core things you have to apply the gospel to. And so what I think the miss was is, we did not give youth leaders, pastors, parents the tools to use the gospel on shame. But I'm not sure that the existence of shame is any, that's not any flaw in the culture. Like, it's not like, well, if we'd done it better, there wouldn't have been, it wouldn't have brought shame. I'm just like, well, the scriptures, this is part of how the scriptures talk, especially about sexual sin, is using the category of shame. And this is shameful. This brings shame. This creates inner shame and a sense of shame in sort of how I relate to the world. And it just feels to me like when I read articles that sort of say the existence of shame in an area is the fault of the culture I grew up in, I'm like, wow, that's overly simplistic.
Yeah. Shame on the leaders who intentionally shamed their youth kids, right? But like you're saying, shame is a natural consequence of sin. Like, we see Adam and Eve in the garden, they realize they're naked and they're ashamed and they cover themselves up.
Yeah, and I think it's a good point, Bob. And I think, you know, again, where the miss was is the way the youth leaders dealt with shame was, don't do it and you won't feel shame.
There wasn't a gospel answer to what if I didn't feel shame.
But it is, that I think that is an important piece. And I think, you know, when she talks about the flip side of this, the just sort of the pure consent piece, that those who have given themselves over to that can't escape the shame that comes with sexual sin. They can bury it in some ways. And I think even, you know, our culture tries to, you know, explain it away, or I shouldn't feel shame, but it's there, it's present. And there's probably a sense where for us as leaders in gospel-centered churches to have a strong gospel answer, both biblical explanation of why that shame is present, but then also a gospel answer, really is an opportunity, as we were talking about last week, to really bring some gospel renewal and some much needed truth to whether someone is in the church or outside the church.
Yeah, there's something else on the obedience piece here that I think is bugging me in the back of my head, which is the way this article is framed. It takes away from me the category of obedience because I love God. Like it assumes that all the emphasis on purity, even if it was sort of legalistic, that the only reason someone would obey that is because a youth leader told them so, or they didn't want to get an STD, or their parents said, you know, like that there's an internal compass that says, well, I should do that because someone told me it's the right thing to do. I realize that if that's the driver, there's a limitation to how far that goes, right? That's either, you know, at some point I have to deal with, why am I wanting to do the right thing? Mm-hmm. But I think, man, I grew up with a real fear of God in this area where I just said, like, I just want to please the Lord here. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, that's the thing, like, whenever we're talking about ethics, mm-hmm. and the category isn't, I would obey this because I just want to please God. Like, I just want God to be honored in this area. That's a category that I just don't hear a lot of people bringing into the equation. And so the polarization becomes like law, shame, guilt versus grace. Mm. And it misses this category of like, but what about a God honoring, God loving, like mm-hmm. a love for God that says, man, I want to obey God's law because I trust God and I trust that He knows what's best. And I do think there were people I ran with that was their motivation for pursuing purity. It wasn't just because the youth leaders told us to, but there's a sense of like, I don't want to honor the Lord. And I don't want to take that away from kids. Nor do I want to throw that out with the bathwater and say, well, yeah, why are we doing that purity culture thing? I'm like, well,
yeah.
I think that the best youth leaders, that's what they were trying to put in place was, man, fear God here. Obey Him. You're going to be blessed. And blessed in the right way, Chris, not in the way that everything's going to work out perfectly for you, but blessed in the sense that you will have the covenantal blessing of obedience.
Yeah.
And that's not a small thing. That's a huge thing.
Yeah. That transcends marital status and how things are panning out for you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, what about this angle of, or I should say negative angle of purity culture? And I'd love to hear your thoughts, Bethany, that one of the things that's been pointed out is that there seemed to be an undue pressure on girls to manage the lust of boys. Hey, dress, you don't want your brother to, you know, fall into sin, so watch what you're wearing, or be careful how you're behaving around him because you are responsible for your brother. And so I've heard this raised as a criticism. Just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that's definitely something that I experienced firsthand. It just put a really weird amount, like I felt this really weird burden of like, I'm responsible for their sin. Like I am causing them to sin. And there was never anything like, we never talked about like, you know, loving one another and wanting the best for them. It was just, it confused me. Like as a young girl, I didn't understand.
I totally resonate with that critique. And then I also say, but there's parts that I don't want to totally throw out.
Yeah.
Because if my mom were sitting around this table, she would be like, yes, and I've told multiple generations of young women, you need to dress modestly. I think that matters. You know, like my mom would say, I think that matters. And, you know, she's like a champion of women. And this is the part where I tell the story of like, yep, and I've had that exact conversation with women who have led worship at Coram Deo. And if they're listening to this podcast, they will know who they are. And they'll be like, yep, that was awkward when Bob said, I need you to go home and change clothes before you come back to lead worship. And, you know, so like I'm realizing, yep, that I think there's ways that can be done that is putting an undue burden on a woman. And I think that was certainly a part of sort of youth group culture was like, hey, it's your job to make sure no men are stumbling. Well, it's actually their job to make sure they're not stumbling. Like they're responsible for their own sin. And yet there is some weird middle ground here of like, what does it mean to honor one another? Which is the category you maybe you felt like you weren't given.
Yeah. And I think I wanted to understand that more, but yeah, I just wasn't, it was, again, it's like going back to that idea, just don't do this. And the youth group leader is like, I'm too afraid to, you know, open a can of worms here and talk about this. I don't know.
And there's a brother, sister, family of God dynamic here, right? That should like, that felt like maybe that's where this was missed too, is this sense of what does it mean for us to be a loving family to one another? When that dynamic's present, you can have a lot of awkward conversations. There's like, well, families have awkward conversations all the time. But when it's like, there's ground we can't tread on or just do the right thing and don't ask questions.
Yeah.
Now we don't have a family conversation. We have a sort of like principal talking to the students and saying, no one may ever wear any red clothing again because it's gang related. Done. End of conversation. You know, I was like, well, okay.
Yeah. This was one of the challenges. I think thinking back to my high school and college years of the nature of guy-girl relationships and how they could be talked about in this dangerous kind of, you need to watch yourself because you just never know where that's going to go, and how that, I think, in some ways stunted the ability to have just friendships with guys and girls of the opposite sex. And and again, when you're in high school, when you're in college, you recognize that emotions can take over, and you there's attraction, and there's the potentiality.
Your frontal lobe is not fully developed.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a potentiality that you're going to develop that, you know, adolescent crush or whatever emotions towards someone. But I think there was also wherever there was a legitimate, hey, be on guard or just be careful, I think the unintended consequence was in some ways to do damage to our ability to just have friendships. And so it was, I can remember just in college, there was a girl that in any way, shape, or form, was this headed towards a dating relationship. We were just friends, and we would hang out once in a while, and people would be like, are you guys dating? You hang out all the time. I'm like, come on. Like, this is just, you know, we're just hanging out. And so all that to say is I understand there's a both and space here, but as I'm thinking through this article and thinking through the culture of our church, can we give, teens, those in middle school, even, you know, college, even adults, good categories of what male-female friendship can look like? And that's probably another podcast topic.
Yeah.
We could talk about the Billy Graham rule. The Mike Pence rule.
Wow.
The Mike Pence. Yeah. Yeah. You had to go there, didn't you?
I did.
So here's Caitlin Beatty's concluding couple of paragraphs. Purity culture, as it was taught to my generation, hurt many people and kept them from knowing the loving, merciful God at the heart of the Christian faith. Again, I feel like that's a dramatic overstatement, and I'm like,
some people were hurt.
Purity culture, as it was taught in your church and to people you personally knew, had damaging effects. And, you know, like there's more nuance needed here, because I feel like that's a dramatic overstatement. But here's what she says. Purity culture, as it was modeled for evangelical teenagers in the 1990s, is not the future of Christian sexual ethics. I think what she's saying there is it's thin, it's flat, it's not robust enough, but neither is the progressive Christian approach that simply baptizes casual sex in the name of self-expression, which is what's going on now. And she mentions in this article, Nadia Bowles Weber, who's a pastor in Denver. I have lots of friends who are church planters in Denver, and this woman like is a big deal in the city of Denver, and she's super progressive and just like, hey, why do we have any sexual ethical categories at all? Do whatever you want, as long as you're like honor one another, consent, you know, but it's sort of like a real progressive, the Bible's ethic is, you know, is outdated and needs to be updated for a new world. And so I appreciate that Caitlin Beatty is saying that's not the answer I need.
Right.
That's not the answer my generation needs, because what it does is it takes away something that was maybe too limited and thin and just throws it out and says, well, we don't need anything except consent. And Caitlin Beatty is saying, I long for something rich and powerful. And there was something about purity culture. Again, she ends with that line, I still find the Christian vision for married sex radical, daunting, and extremely compelling. And that's the thing that provokes me, is to say, okay, that's true. How do we teach that ethic, put that vision forward, and talk about purity? Because I don't think we can't, like, going back to what you just said, Chris, like a 15-year-old has a limited capacity for nuance and complexity. Like they need some clarity.
Yeah.
And sometimes just, hey, don't do that is helpful to hear when you're 15. My kids always want to reason about the complexities, but usually so they can find some wiggle room about why this
loophole.
Is, you know, yeah, some loopholes. I was like, look, here's what you know. Don't do stupid stuff. Okay. Don't disobey God. The Bible exists for a reason. God knows what he's talking about. Do what he says and you'll be blessed. We need that,
mm-hmm.
But we need a bigger and fuller vision than that as well. And I think there's an invitation and a call here to the church to say, how do we build that? How do we build that in our churches, among our, in our families, and for the youth that we're responsible for? How do we help them embrace a God honoring and God sized vision of sexual purity and of sexuality in general?
In light of our conversation last week, it seems like this sexual ethic of consent isn't going to go very well. Like,
yeah,
it's going to backfire. I mean, it's just modeling what the culture is already modeling.
Well, and it's not a Christian ethic in the first place, right?
Right.
Like, that's
yeah.
the thing is like, it's a cultural ethic, but it's the flattest and most simplest, it has zero sense of a biblical fullness to it. So
it's very individualistic. Yeah. It's not, yeah, it's,
I mean, basically that, the heart of that ethic is preventing rape.
Right.
I mean, that's what it seems to be. It doesn't seem to be have any forward thinking as far as building actual relationship, actual depth, and actually appreciating the power of sex. And she points that out.
Consent, she says, protects against sexual assault and other forms of coercion, but it doesn't protect against people using one another in quieter ways, right. Which is a really good line.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
There's still a ton of using each other in selfishness and that can exist in that kind of a world. And she's rightly pointing that out.
A quote from Reverend Nadia is, it's time for us to grab some matches and haul our antiquated and harmful ideas about sex, bodies, and gender into the yard, burn it, and start over. And so it's more than just a man and a woman consenting. She's throwing all of the Christian sex ethic out.
Yes. And as you said, that's not going to go well in the long run. I mean, what's sad for me is realizing if Caitlin Beatty is speaking to a certain number of people that really are out there who mm-hmm. were hurt or damaged or felt like, man, purity culture did me wrong and it did not help me mm-hmm. understand God's vision for sexuality. What we're going to have in 20 years in the church is an endless load of counseling from mm-hmm. people who have just run off the rails and consent was their only rubric and, mm-hmm. and they're just hurting, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's, so I feel that of like, I don't want those to be our children, right? I want to say like, hey, the kids that we disciple and raise, how do we give them a robust biblical framework mm-hmm. that includes law, mm-hmm. obedience, purity, the mm-hmm. glory of God, mm-hmm. but also holiness and God's vision for married sexuality mm-hmm. and the sacredness of mm-hmm. sexuality.
And also the capacity to show grace to their friends who are experiencing that pain and shame and all that. Because I think that was what was also missing too, is we didn't have a category for, well, what if your friend does screw up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
How do you treat them?
Yeah.
You know, how do you love them still? And so I think the gospel gives us lots of room to grow in that as well. Bethany, thanks for joining us today. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Amen.
Pleasure was all mine.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in, and we pray that this conversation was helpful to you as you minister in your own context. We always love to hear from you, the listeners, so send us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com, and do us a favor, leave a review. A 5-star review on iTunes.
A great
or wherever
review.
You listen to your podcast. And we'll see you again next week for another Wednesday conversation.